As we get into Psalm 40 for a few Sundays, I want to begin by making a general observation about the Psalms and then a specific observation about this Psalm in particular. The general observation is that the Psalms are always transparent. And if you've spent any time in the Psalms, you've noticed this. You may not have put that word with it. But to say the Psalms are always transparent is to say that the Psalms deal fully, honestly, with the condition of life in a fallen world where God is yet at work, delivering, preserving, and redeeming. That's the general observation. The specific observation is that this psalmist, David, this is one of his psalms, he practices transparency with vulnerability actually quite often. How does transparency and vulnerability fit together? Well, transparency is honesty about the condition of life that I'm in. And we see this in Psalm 40, David's honesty about a difficult stretch of life that he likens, the imagery in verse 2, is a pit of destruction or a miry bog. And bogs are wetlands. You don't go for casual walks in places with bogs because you might fall in. The ground can't support your weight. And bogs, furthermore, are known to be rather stenchy, and they are habitat for critters that you don't want to necessarily meet on their own boggy turf. I'm thinking back to a camp I went to as a boy in Alabama. It featured a big mud bog, and the camp instructions were that the clothes your son took with him to camp for bog day aren't coming back home. So make sure that those are clothes that can be thrown out. And I have a vivid memory of a long snake swimming across that bog as a bunch of us boys were in there, and suddenly you get all this prepubescent shrieking, you know, like boys do, and we're making way. I'm sure the snake was petrified, and we were scared to death trying to get out of his way. And the place stank. I remember that about that bog. It was just the odor of that has stayed with me all these years. David says to us in Psalm 40 that the bog, verse 2, it's not a fun place to sink into. Nor is the pit. That's also in verse 2. We're going to key on this imagery here in verse 2 this morning of the pit and the bog. Because while the bog might be something that you fall into, the pit is something that you're thrown into. You see this in Joseph's experience. His brothers threw him in a pit. You see this in Jeremiah, the prophet's experience. He was thrown into a pit. I'm going to practice a measure of transparency and vulnerability preaching Psalm 40 over the next couple of weeks in reference to the pit and the bog that we've been in with our oldest son. And it's his pit and his bog as well. And being vulnerable means that I take a risk with transparency. Risks like, and we all take these risks when we're vulnerable. If I'm vulnerable about this particular thing in my life, whatever factor X is, you might think differently of me. Or the risk of if you know this about me, this might make you uncomfortable. Or the risk of you could misuse the information that I give you, etc. and so on. There's all these risks in vulnerability. And I don't think vulnerability requires courage so much as it does learning to bank your ultimate safety with God. I think it's more about security than courage. Because if you do that, if you bank your ultimate safety with God, you can venture into the waters of transparency and vulnerability. And if you do that, if you venture into these waters of transparency and vulnerability, you do that in search of providing something meaningful for others. Otherwise, there's no reason to do it. In this vein, I like how Andy Crouch writes about vulnerability in his book, Strong and Weak. He talks about how vulnerability is the capacity for meaningful risk. We think of vulnerability and transparency as some kind of emotional vomiting, but it's really not that. It's risking the risks you risk in being transparent in the interest of something meaningful potentially coming out of this. Transparency and vulnerability are not automatically meaningful. Vulnerability can be an act of grandstanding. calling attention to oneself because one wants to be thought courageous. But it's not about locating your courage. It's all about where you locate your safety. Vulnerability can be manipulative, not in the interest of ministering to others, but exploiting them, actually, empowering oneself through soliciting this kind of a soft sympathy. So suddenly this is the buffer for your life. It's a soft sympathy because you don't want to be morally accountable anymore going forward. And so because of what you've been through, if somebody then tries to check and balance your attitude, your conduct, your beliefs, you come back with, well, look what I've been through in life. How could you put that on me? Those are not the intended fruits of transparency and vulnerability in service to others. My own mother is a good example to summon in that she grew up in an alcoholic's home, which definitely affects you, as a number of you in this room know from personal experience. It wounds. It scars. There's no way to experience that and it not affect you ongoing. However, I never once heard my mom ever offer that up as an excuse for herself for anything. My mom never used that to gain something for herself manipulatively, as if because I had this experience, now y'all all get out of my way and let me have a bad day because I'm the child of an alcoholic. No, my mother met Christ. And while the Lord knows, meeting him, this is where evangelicals need to be more transparent, because evangelicals are the worst at presenting these algebraic equations for life. If we just do this and this and this and this, everything will follow. And the Lord knows, meeting him doesn't fix everything in your life. I'm sorry. I'm truly sorry if somebody gave you that impression coming to Christ. I really am. That's no joke attached to that. If somebody gave you the impression that everything in your life would suddenly come together, or they gave you the impression that nothing in your life would fall apart, they gave you the wrong impression. That's a prosperity notion of Christianity that is a heresy, a particularly American heresy, but a heresy nonetheless. My mother grew in Jesus' love and grace such that through a real effort of work in following Christ, was able to offer my grandfather reconciling mercy, whereas her brother, my uncle, did not. He resented my mother for doing that, in fact, and chooses to live estranged from her. I've seen the damage. I tell you that because I've seen the family damage addiction can do. It's done it in my own family, on both sides of my family tree, and I've also seen the healing that Christ can bring. And we're walking both sides of this street now in our family with Caleb, our 21-year-old son, brother to three sisters, and one younger brother. And someone who is a part of this church, he came here when he was 6, 7 years old. He was baptized among us. He was an Awana kid, a cubby, a Sparky. I can't remember if he did TNT or not. And he was a part of our youth group, and he played his guitar in our worship service. He's someone a lot of you know and love, and you're praying for, and you're pulling for him now in this, and we thank you, speaking for Lynn and my family. He's in a treatment program out west for now that he wanted to go to. You learn in these cases, you say for now. And going to that, wanting to go to that, it's the only way addiction treatment has a chance to work in most cases. People always talk about hitting bottom. Hitting bottom is a very relative thing. I don't know whether Caleb hit bottom or not. Just when you think it's bottom floor, you find that the thing goes way down. But I do know, I only know the addict has to want to go to treatment or it's an empty exercise. And even then, there's no guarantee of it taking without real work. And Caleb may have relapses. 10 years from now, we may be in the very same place today that we're in with him, which is waiting, hoping. This is why sobriety and recovery is a thing frequently celebrated, not taken for granted by those in it. It takes ongoing work in a community that knows how to support you in order to stay clean and sober, even in and with Christ. We landed in Psalm 40, Lynn and I, as we watched our oldest son's life spiral. We landed in this particular psalm for a couple of reasons. One, because the imageries all the way through this psalm really connected with us. They resonated with our experience, in particular parenting this particular child in our home who has addiction issues. We landed in Psalm 40 because we see Jesus here. Did you catch the glimpse of him in verses 7 and 8? You did if you know that the book of Hebrews quotes Psalm 40 in reference to Jesus, and if you remember that place in Luke 24 where the two disciples are on their way to Emmaus and Jesus meets up with them and takes the Old Testament and tells them all about himself, which would have included these two verses in Psalm 40, verse 7. Then I said, behold, I have come. In the scroll of the book, it is written of me. I delight to do your will, O my God. Your law is within my heart. This is applied to Jesus in the New Testament. The me is him. Read Hebrews. The Bible is a single great story about Jesus and his delivering grace from start to finish and all the way through. Those are our reasons. Oh, and I've got one more reason. We land in Psalm 40 because of the Bono factor. The Irish rock band, U2, my favorite band of all time, the 1983 War album, on the cover of which is a kid who looks just like Colson, my youngest. You can Google that. I give you permission. They sang Psalm 40 on that album. They were playing around in the studio, the story goes, and somebody said, hey, let's just turn to some place in Scripture and let Bono sing about it. And they turned to Psalm 40, and it became a hit. It's just called 40. Bono knows Jesus, and Caleb and I share a love of U2's music. You know how it is when you're parenting and you try to connect with your kids. And that was one of the things that I already brought into the relationship that he connected with me through. And this made Psalm 40 in particular a good place to cry out to God for his life. In fact, I cannot listen to Psalm 40 now on my iPod without crying now. I just can't do it. I couldn't listen to it with Ken reading it. I get to verse 12. Evils have encompassed me beyond number. My iniquities have overtaken me. I cannot see. They are more than the hairs of my head. My heart fails me. And it just gets me. Bono has a song. U2 has a song called I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, which Bono calls a gospel song with a restless spirit. I love that description. Because I think Psalm 40 we can call a hopeful song from the helpless bog, from the horrible pit. That's what the imagery conveys. The pit is a place of horror. To be thrown into that, the bog is a place of helplessness, this feeling of, how did I get here? Psalm 40 articulates hopefulness in the place of helplessness. I'm not going to be too detailed with you as we go through this. And that's for Caleb's sake. He knows that we're talking. He approved it. We're not being secretive with you, but we will maintain some privacy. And you know, it's as God works through these things, the encouragements I'm receiving from many of you who have written to me, who have caught me in the hall, who have come by my office to say, I know this pit too. I know this bog. Addiction is something that has touched and is touching and will touch more of us in this church than you might realize. But this series, though it's very personal for me, this psalm, this series is not about Caleb. And it's not about the Huffmans. This series is about Jesus, who again is in Psalm 40, because Psalm 40 is about David's deliverer, who also happens to be Caleb's deliverer, who also happens to be yours and my deliverer, and his name is Jesus. But the thing that we see in Psalm 40 is that he works on his own time, and he works in his own way, but he works. And we see from this psalm that he is doing more, though we implore him to speed it up. Verse 13, verse 17, be my help, O Lord. Make haste to help me. Come quickly. He's doing more than we know at any given time. But again, just to put not to put too fine a point on it, but just to ensure no misunderstanding. Well, to say that I expect some misunderstanding, actually, weaving our story through Psalm 40, vulnerability comes with a set of risks, and I'm taking these risks on. For instance, I risk this some using Psalm 40, not Psalm 40, but 1 Timothy 3:4 against me. 1 Timothy 3:4 is the passage where the elder has to manage his own household well. And I've been in this church almost 15 years, and I know there are some of you who will say that verse now means that I shouldn't be doing what I'm doing. I know that. That's just a given in our church. Most of you, that's not the case, but some of you, it is. That's a risk that I run. I risk some of you painting Caleb with the troubled kid brush and holding that over him and making it difficult for him to ever be among us again. I realized in some counseling that we pursued, evangelicals call it counseling, the rest of the world calls it therapy. It's one of these weird tics of ours. I realized that one of my sins against my son was holding his sins in this over him. And to his credit, he never punished me for that. I've punished him. I've lacerated him with angry words. I have practiced avoidance, where I've been in his presence and won't even look at him. I've been resentful about everything that comes with being party to the fallouts from somebody's partying. And I mean everything. We've run the gamut. We've seen it about it. We've seen about everything except Caleb has never lashed out at Lenormee. And we've heard stories now many times over of parents getting screamed and cursed at, fist fights in the living room. We've had plenty of troubles with our oldest, particularly when the drugs began, but we've just not had relational chaos. And I even run the risk in that of those of you who've had that saying, well, then you don't really know what this is like. But our dynamic has been instead, with him in particular, watching a lot of self-destruction. Just watching a beautiful boy destroy himself. And feeling as the people who love him ridiculously helpless to do anything to stop it. And a lot of you in this room have walked this, and you know this. And you know, I'm intentionally using this word helpless because it's in Psalm 40. You're not going to see the word helpless, but when you see miry bog, this imagery now in verse 2, specifically, that's about helplessness. That's what the miry bog is picturing. If I use miry bog and I'm David, I'm trying to convey to you a feeling of helplessness in my difficult stretch. When we look at Psalm 40, we see David coming out of a difficult stretch. Psalm 40 is likely penned with the memory of the stench of the bog still fresh, recallable, and maybe he's still in the residual effects of the hard stretch. We don't know. When you look at verse 2, the imagery here, the pit of destruction, the miry bog, we don't know specifically what David is referring to any more than we know specifically what Paul is referring to when he talks about his thorn. This pit, this bog, could have been for David sin-related. Again, judging from verse 12, where he talks about my iniquities have overtaken me, but he also references foes. Those who seek my life. That's in verses 14 and 15. They utilized pits, as I mentioned. Throw you into a pit and leave you there to die. So the imagery of the pit and the bog, verse 2, really biblically amplifying this out, this could be anything. This could be sickness, can be a pit or a bog. Sin can be a pit or a bog. Satan can create pits and bogs. We don't know for sure what this was for David. We do know that David's life, he experienced all three. Sin and sickness and Satan. Matter of public record in the Old Testament books of Samuel and Chronicles that tell us about his life. Psalm 40 seems apropos to someone in addiction, mired in this in particular. And I'm saying this as a pastor, not as a clinician. But from a pastoral view of addiction, it seems to me, when you take everything into account, it's a toxic combination of all three things. It is a sickness. There is disease component to addiction, very similar to the way diabetes works. There are sinful choices that get made, certainly, and there is Satan involved in destruction. The thief comes to steal, to kill, and destroy. Jesus comes to give life. I'm not interested in pie charting how much of each one it is in the addictive construct, but when I read verse 2, the pit and the bog are fitting depictions of what addiction is like, both for those in it and those who love those in it. And these words here for pit of destruction and miry bog suggest not just a horrible situation, but a situation of horror. That's the pit of destruction. Floundering helplessness, that's the miry bog. But not hopelessness. Oh no. Not with an open Bible, not with a reaching God. Look at verse 1 and 2. I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me and heard my cry. He drew me up from the pit of destruction, out of the miry bog, set my feet upon a rock, making my steps secure. And there's all these references to deliverance. At least four in this psalm we'll unpack in sermons to follow. But there's no hopelessness here. Helplessness? Yeah. There's a lot of that. Verse 2, verse 12 articulate helplessness. And I've felt that. I've known that in the last few years as this unfolded. Floundering helplessness. You ever been there? You don't immediately know what to do, even if you're wise. Here I was walking along. I was watching Caleb grow up, playing his guitar, getting good at it, playing sports, listening to him dream his dreams aloud, graduating high school, gets a full tuition scholarship to university because he's bright. And he's handsome and he's funny and he's reflective. But then suddenly and gradually, all at once and over time, the road changes beneath our feet. The road becomes a miry bog and you think, how did we get here? We did so much right, we thought. I was talking with a pastor in Knoxville about this, John Wood. I called him up. He's been through the same thing with his son. He's the pastor at Cedar Springs. We had a great conversation. And he said, you know, Cole, this is the area of life where the church hasn't always served our people because we've held up the model of parenting. We've said, you know, if you want your kids to be like this and you do this and that and the other. And he said, for so many of us, there's been that experience. It hasn't played out like that. And it's not the fault of what we've done. We did so much right. None of us in this room believe the myth of perfect parenting. Some of you who are younger parents, if I may speak to the younger parents in the room with kids who just ran out of this service. And thank God they run. We ought to tell them to run every time they come. You run. God made you to run. Nobody's going to tell you to stop. Some of them will go there. Some of you will know the sinkholing beneath your feet with your child, and I hope we're there for you in that time when you do, as others have been there for us and still are. But don't live in dread of this because you don't know tomorrow. Don't start worrying about it. Not going to do you any good. You got a kid, a little kid who's a handful for you, don't tell him stuff like, well, we're either saving up for your tuition or your bail. Which one is it? We're not sure. We're not. Ha ha ha. Don't do that to him or her. But listen, young parent with kids back in the nursery right now, there is nothing you are going to do, even if you do so much right, to prevent this from happening if it does. And my saying that is not fatalistic. Child rearing is not programming. I'm not saying you can't influence your child. I'm not saying that we don't utilize evangelical resources. Do. They're out there. They're good. Even young parents who are teaching us how to parent our kids, and their kids are all little and they don't know what they're talking about, they mean well. They mean well. Really, they do. And they're trying to get wisdom. Listen to them. You can learn from them. Teach your children the scriptures. Get them into Christian community. Set them up with disciplers and mentors who will reinforce what you want for them of Christ as they come along. But they are still human beings, your kids. And the only thing I fault the evangelical church for is that we don't let people be human. We get this sense that now in Christ, somehow you become, not a human anymore. You're still a human. You've still got faults and flaws, and Christ in you is the hope of glory. Meaning what? Meaning someday I won't have these flaws and faults anymore. But right now I do. And the Holy Spirit of God keeps me in check and keeps me working in a different direction than building on those flaws and faults and sins and whatnot. But your kids have sin natures, and they're going to activate those sin natures. And you can't make them love the Lord. You can teach them, and you can influence them, and you can imprint on them. But you may find your children, for whatever reasons, don't build on the foundation you give them. And mom and dad, that doesn't mean you poured a bad foundation. It means the world is, for now, as the scriptures tell us it is, a place of risk, a place under judgment, a place where a very real enemy named Satan roars and goes about like a lion seeking someone to devour. It means in our fallenness, someone can innocently try a beer, which is almost treated like a rite of passage in our country. They can try that, and for that person, this is the disease component. It hits their brain in a way they don't understand and they don't see coming. But now, suddenly, they are craving more and more and more hits of that in a society that is built around alcohol. That's the sickness part, and it is just there in you chemically, even if you've memorized 250 Bible verses. What I want you to see in this message is that helplessness and hopelessness are not the same thing. And this is a crucial distinction for people in Christ to understand. Psalm 40 gives expression to helplessness. Lord, I don't know what to do. Where are you in this? Which way is up? Which way is out? Psalm 40 articulates the helplessness one feels in any kind of pit, but this pit in particular, where sin, sickness, Satan, the orchestrated opportunism of self-destruction, where they converge. And you've got a child, you've got a brother, a sister, a spouse, you yourself. I don't for a moment think that there aren't people in our congregation who are addicted. You're addicted to pain medication, some of you. Some of you are in the closet with your alcoholism. I have nothing but compassion for you. I'm going to be the last person in this church who's going to condemn you. But hopefully what this series does, what we get from this is just a sense that it's okay to be honest about that and to begin moving toward health in that. To come out of those places where we hide away, where we kind of craft a bog and a pit for ourselves, and to say, Lord Jesus, I need your help. I'm waiting patiently on you for you to lift me out and put me on a rock. It's not easy. It's not simple. It's not a matter of just believe this more. If that's your view, please keep that to yourself. It's not helpful for the rest of us. It's work. It's work. What we do not see in Psalm 40 is hopelessness, because helplessness is dark. It's a dark place, but hopelessness is more like hell. And you've been redeemed from there. Helplessness, pit of destruction, miry bog, which way is up, which way is out, how long, O Lord, are we in here for? That's the helplessness Psalm 40 gives expression to. But hopelessness is more like hell, because hell is a place completely devoid of the light of hope and the reach of God. Hell is only an utter darkness into which God does not reach, and that's not a Christian's experience of anything. David is in this dark place where sin, sickness, Satan converge, or one of them predominates. It doesn't really matter in actual experience. But we see in the text that while David experiences this difficult stretch as a place of helplessness in which he cries out to God for help, he did not experience it as a place of hopelessness. Why? Because God is reaching. And God reaches in, only not immediately. I waited patiently for the Lord. You've got a juxtaposition in this psalm. I waited patiently for the Lord. Verse 1, He inclined to me and heard my cry, drew me up from the pit of destruction, out of the miry bog, set my feet upon a rock, making my steps secure. You get down to verse 13. O Lord, make haste to help me. Verse 17, You're my help and deliverer. Don't delay, O God. There may be in this the sense that if I go through this again, or if this is not finished, Lord, You know what this is like, and I know what this is like, and I don't want to keep going with this anymore. I just want to introduce something to you today, and then we're done. I want to come back to it and develop it. The idea is that patience is bearing the burden of hoping. That's our series title. I see it there on the, I've got screens in front of me here. If you ever wonder why I'm looking at the front at the TVs, it's not because they have a game running for me right now. I don't care to watch my team play anymore. I was just there last night watching that debacle. Bearing the burden of hoping. Not an insight unique to me, as if any insight is unique to me, but back in September, Phil Herndon is a therapist in Nashville, and he was here speaking to our council retreat. And Phil Herndon said something. He gave that definition of patience, and I latched onto it because it was like, that is it. That describes the experience. Patience is bearing the burden of hoping. I waited patiently for the Lord. I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me and heard my cry. You've heard all of your life that patience is a virtue. And it is, in that people appreciate your being patient with them, particularly people in service industries. If you're a patient person, if you're not hard to please, then you leave a very nice fragrance behind you. What a patient guy. That guy was a delight to work with at the airport counter or at the rental car place or wherever. So that is a part of patience, but patience is also a burden. Patience is bearing the burden of hoping. And it's not a burden we bear alone. We need others to bear it with us, and we needed Jesus to bear it before us, and He did. Verse 7, here it is written, Behold, I've come in the scroll of the book. I delight to do Your will, O my God. Your law is within my heart. Isn't it telling that in the psalm in our Bible that celebrates recovery, it has to be about the Messiah? Who, because He delighted in doing God's will, that meant there would be no pit so deep, no miry bog so miry, that He cannot reach into and lift you from. Why? Because He Himself bore the burden of our hoping. All our hopes, every hope you have in life runs through Him, whether you know it or not, and it will not be satisfied apart from Him, whether you know it or not. This is where Psalm 40 takes us. Final word. And then we're going to sing a song together that is Psalm 40, and it's to the tune of Amazing Grace. So you'll pick it up. It is not enough just to have recovery. I'll come back to this idea. Small R recovery, that is, recovery is very good and it's to be celebrated. But it's not enough. Taking nothing away from it, the hope burden we bear for our oldest son and that we bear for anyone thrown in pits of destruction, whether they put themselves there or somebody else did, mired in bogs of all kinds, is recovery with a capital R. because that recovery, capital R recovery, it takes us to the ultimate burden bearer. The only one large enough to bear the burdens of all of our hopes. Because he did the will of God on our behalf. You know what that means? That means the life of God is accessible to us in him.